It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here as we examine a common way of fixing sewer pipes in our country and the potential effects on human health with noxious fumes. Call in with your questions and concerns about what are called cured-in-place pipe repair projects. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Andrew Welton is a professor of civil engineering and environmental and ecological engineering at Purdue University, studying the risks of these repair techniques. Andrew, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been sounding the alarm bells on this method for over a decade now. We've recently seen a report in USA Today chronicling incidents of people getting sick, including in 2021 at a middle school in Spooner, Wisconsin. Can you explain how cured-in-place pipelining works?
Absolutely. It's an innovative technology where pipes that are buried beneath the ground are fixed in place without having to dig them up and shut down roads. But one of the issues, which is really central to the technology, is that you soak a sock in resin or raw chemical, you slide it into the pipe, and then you cook it. The problem is the waste is not captured. It's often just blown directly into environment and into nearby buildings, which is what happened, I believe, in Spooner, Wisconsin.
And so you say this is innovative, but hasn't it been around, this technique, for decades?
It has. It came in the 1970s into the U.S., but it once a patent expired for a company called Insituform Technologies, a lot of different companies started forming to do this technique as well. And so as the infrastructure needs repaired, this is a relatively inexpensive, quick process that a lot of people see an opportunity to make money from.
Is the resin formula, the resin recipe, if you will, is that standardized? Or are there a lot of different types of ways that you can cure pipes with different various resin recipes?
So that's a great question. Initially, when we started getting involved 10 years ago, the industry said that there's really only one or two different types of resins. But it turns out there's been over 20 different types of resins used, and each of them have different chemistries or different chemicals in them. When you cook the resins and you transform them in from a liquid to a plastic, a hard plastic, you can either use UV light, steam, hot water, or you can just let it cook itself in the ambient air.
And so when we see steam rising up from a sewer hole, you can that suggests that this technique is being used.
Well, I would first caution you and all your listeners that what's coming out of the sewer hole isn't steam when this technology is used. We figured that out in 2017. That is nothing like a shower that you would, you know, take a steam shower in. That is raw liquid droplets of pure chemical, particulates, wax, microplastics, and nanoplastics coming out. So I would avoid going near that waste emission.
Why is this technique risky for human health? What is in that concoction of organic compounds that is hurting human health?
Well, it turns out that many of the workers and even the company owners that bought the technology didn't really understand what types of chemicals that they were handling and discharging into the environment and nearby buildings. The chemicals that have gotten the most discussion are styrene, which is a probable carcinogen. It can be acutely toxic if you're exposed to it, especially for children and immunocompromised people. But there's a whole host of other chemicals in that emission, such as methylene chloride, sometimes benzene, sometimes other chemicals, which are known to cause, you know, immediate health impacts.
We're talking about the risks with a commonly used form of pipe repair with Andrew Welton, professor and director of the Healthy Plumbing Consortium at Purdue University. You can join in with your questions, your comments on this type of cured-in-place pipe lining, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Andrew, explain the upsides here, the advantages for this type of pipe repair. I would imagine it's way more cost-effective than digging up a pipe and replacing it.
Absolutely. So this technology can be about 80% less expensive than digging up a pipe. And so when officials are challenged with a limited budget and they can replace 80 miles of pipe or 20 miles of pipe, they'd prefer the 80 miles. The challenge here is just the waste emission. And there are ways to capture or just minimize the amount of waste you're producing. But right now, the cheapest approach for using this technology, which is what everybody generally pursues, is the one where the waste is blown into the environment in nearby buildings.
In 2017, you said this method is used in about half of pipe repairs in our country. Is that statistic still holding up?
I think it's probably used in potentially every county across the country. We've seen ebbs and flows with regards to how popular it is. But I would say that, yes, it is the most common pipe repair placement technology in the United States.
And then the other option, though, is to just dig up and replace the pipe and repair it that way? Or are there other ways that you can do this?
So the excavation approach, where you dig up a broken pipe and you install a new pipe, is what is often compared against for CIPP technology. And that is costly, that shuts down roadways, people are out of sewer or water service for days, sometimes weeks. There are other technologies that you can use. There's one called slip lining, where you slide a smaller plastic pipe that's already formed inside the existing pipe. And there's other technologies as well, but CIPP is the least expensive, generally fastest way to repair pipes in place.
You know, I'm thinking about that there are poisonous lead pipes. There are lead laterals that are being replaced in cities all around the country, including here in Wisconsin. Is this method used for that type of repair?
It actually is. Less than 1%, though, of all drinking water pipes are being replaced using CIPP. And that's primarily because many of the approaches or pilot projects weren't successful. And so the industry is trying to figure out how to successfully use this on a larger scale for drinking water pipes, but it really hasn't caught on yet.
I would be really concerned to ensure that the testing is there, because I'd be worried about leaching from the resin over time.
And that's a valid concern. One way that industry approaches leaching from plastics is that they pay a third party that conducts leaching testing on their products. One of the challenges, however, with the transformation of our pipes from metal to plastic when it comes to drinking water is that many of the chemicals that leach out of these plastics are not on the list of things that you actually look for. And so we need to put a little more effort into understanding what's happening as we transition from metal to plastic world.
Purdue University civil engineering professor Andrew Welton, researching the effects of cured-in-place pipelining projects. Call in with your questions, your concerns about this approach to pipe repair. What have you have learned about it? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn what's in chemical plumes rising from sewer hole covers when repairs are underway using the cured-in-place pipe repair method. Call in with questions and thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Andrew Welton is a professor of civil engineering and environmental and ecological engineering at Purdue University. Andrew, the National Association of Sewer Service Companies, they've pushed back on your findings about cured-in-place piping, and they denounced your peer-reviewed study you led in 2017 that found it puts pollutants in the air, as we've been talking about. And the group later led a study that says your results were non-conclusive. How have these companies responded in years since?
So back in 2017, when we discovered that the emissions coming out of these manholes were not steam, we talked to many CIPP company owners and members of this organization called NASCO, and they were not aware that the materials posed an acute health risk and even long-term health risk to their own workers. Some of these workers were family members that worked for their companies that had been in these manholes and such. So there was a lot of concern and anxiety within these agencies and organizations, and that prompted organizations to lash out and put a whole bunch of misinformation out there into the industry, into the public space, which I attribute a lot of this to.
Have you responded with more research? What has been your pushback here?
Well, we are not pushing back. Because there's nothing to push back against. We were funded by the National Science Foundation, NSF.gov, the National Institutes of Health, Environmental Sciences, the Federal Highway Administration, the US EPA. Over the years, we have just been working to get answers for workers and the public and health officials to understand what to do about it and what the consequences are of exposure.
What regulatory body should be addressing these emissions?
So from a worker safety standpoint, OSHA is responsible, and even state OSHA agencies are responsible. Many of these agencies were not aware that this process was taking place in their states and in the country, and so they're trying to get up to speed. In the general public space, you know, children, people in their homes and schools, that is the U.S. EPA's responsibility to regulate and oversee the protection of public health when it comes to chemicals and air. And then states are also responsible for protecting their own citizens against chemical exposures due to ambient air or indoor air. And many of these agencies were simply unaware that this was happening.
Have any of these agencies taken a lead on this or made it a priority?
So actually, last year, the Washington, D.C. Department of Energy and the Environment, or DOEE, which is a local air quality regulator for where people live in Washington, D.C., legally compelled a water utility to conduct air testing during their CIPP projects. And that is, to my knowledge, the first time this has ever happened. That was done so out of concern that the water utility and the CIPP contractors couldn't accurately explain to the regulator what exactly the risks were associated with their technology.
Did they publish those findings?
That's ongoing, but one of the challenges is that the utility hired an industry-focused research team that had previously put out information that was inaccurate. So there's concern that it's potentially that there's no independence associated with that study.
You bring up the safety and harm of workers in doing this cured-in-place piping process. Are you aware of any class action lawsuits?
I am not aware of any class action lawsuits associated with this. Generally, what we've seen is workers settle with their companies and then sign non-disclosure agreements. And I know that firsthand because workers have called me right before they settled and told me some things.
Let's go to Tamara in Ashland. Hi, Tamara. What is your question?
Hello there. I'm wondering how cities get to choose who works on these pipelines. I was at my residence with my grandson and my son, and we have asthma. And suddenly we couldn't breathe and we're very sick. And outside our house, somebody was working on the sewer pipe, and they were not attending it was like this trailer over the sewer pipe, and the steam was bellowing everywhere, and my grandson and my son and I had to leave the area because we felt sick. And Ashland decided this was the best way to approach this. And I'm wondering what I can do, you know, to influence that decision making, or how to protect myself when they're doing this work.
Tamara, thank you for bringing that personal story. Andrew.
So, Tamara, I'm sorry that that happened to you and your family. It shouldn't have happened. The way that you can protect yourself, first of all, is having a utility that's responsible, that recognizes the risk that the plastic manufacturing waste poses to its people. So there are ways that you can specify in the contracts that the waste is captured, or certain technologies are avoided, and certain resins are avoided. As far as using that technology, if it's used, you'll often hear contractors say, pour water in your plumbing traps, but that doesn't always work because the emissions can waft across your property, through your windows, cracks and doors, and such like that. So really what we recommend people to do is evacuate their building if they are very concerned about it, especially if they have immunocompromised populations. And then also, if there are any health impacts and such, contractors and utilities like you to go to them to contain the information. And the fact of the matter is, neither of them have medical training. And so you really should go to a public health official or a medical doctor for medical and exposure advice, not the people who just want to fix a pipe and kind of move on.
Andrew Welton with us, a professor and director of the Healthy Plumbing Consortium at Purdue University, as we explore the cured in place pipelining process. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. You know, Tamara mentions trying to understand or get at the root of this before it actually happens and it's outside your door and happening. You know, President Biden has this infrastructure law, historic infrastructure law, supposed to provide funds to rehab and replace aging infrastructure. How can communities be sure their sewer lines are updated safely when the money is there?
So the new infrastructure money coming down from the federal government to different states will undoubtedly increase the number of CIPP projects in communities nationwide. And the way that that can be positively influenced to protect people from harm so that their pipes can be fixed in an economical way is that state agencies that are responsible for handing out that money require that these municipalities have certain controls in place if they use CIPP technology. So municipalities have to go to the state to obtain low interest loans. And as part of that, you can insert conditions that require certain actions in those loan applications. That's one way that the state can better protect people across Wisconsin and elsewhere in the country.
Turning to how to keep yourself safe, you mentioned evacuate. For how long? How is there any knowledge of how long these chemicals stay in the air?
So generally, people say that the chemicals, stay in the air for, hours to a couple days if they do enter and there's no way for the chemicals to get out. We have encountered several situations where contractors leached out actually raw resin inside the sewer line, which didn't cook, and therefore it simply off-gassed and vapors went up for months, people's sewer laterals. So there's a number of different situations where you may have just a couple hours the chemical exposures occur, or it could occur longer. That's why people need to engage their health officials, their public health officials, because those people can advocate on their behalf.
So if that pipe doesn't cure or cook properly, does that mean they have to redo the process, or how do you fix that?
Well, that's a great question. Sometimes contractors come back and didn't run water down it. To try to flush out the uncooked resin. Sometimes there's another pass at the cooking process. And sometimes they'll go in and they'll cut a hole in the pipe to kind of suck out any uncooked resin and then patch it and fix it.
Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Andrew Welton is a professor of civil engineering and environmental and ecological engineering at Purdue University. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore a democracy tool now that encourages residents to decide on how a portion of taxpayer dollars should be spent. Chicago was an early adopter of participatory budgeting in 2009. Fast forward to recent here, the African American Roundtable in Milwaukee announced it's launching a participatory budgeting program. Call in with questions and comments about this process, giving residents a say in how city funds are spent. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ingrid Haftel is Director of Community Education at the Participatory Budgeting Project. Ingrid, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. I'm so glad to be here.
Good morning. So how is this type of budgeting different from, say, traditional budgeting processes?
Yeah. So, you know, if you know anything about your local budgeting process, it might actually not be very much because typically the way that public budgeting happens, it really feels like it's happening behind closed doors. And the way that folks like you and me, people in communities, have power over that process is by electing someone to make decisions about how money gets spent. And we know that that's not working very well for so many Americans right now, particularly because we know that that process has different outcomes based on what your race is, what your income is, what your immigration status is. And so PB is really different. It's community-led decision-making, and it's designed to be community-led from start to finish. As we advocate for it, PB has five different phases that community members really lead on the decision-making of at each phase. It starts with designing the process. So what are the goals for the participatory budgeting process, and what are the rules? The process then moves into idea collection, where community members have the power to directly propose ideas for how money should get spent. Next, proposals are developed, and that's where volunteers from the community come together to kind of polish those ideas into real, feasible proposals that meet people's needs. Folks then get to vote, so that's where we get to have a direct say over what gets funded. And finally, winning projects get implemented and evaluated. Ideally, that's done with, you know, reflection, done with transparency, and done with an eye to doing it all again, because PB is not just a one-off deal. It's actually a muscle, a cycle, a practice we want to build to do over and over again.
Well, I just kind of wiped the sweat off my brow and said, phew, that is some process. And, you know, here comes that pushback. There's this concern that, you know, too much participation can derail a budget process or make budgeting too time consuming and too arduous. What is your reaction?
No, it's a good question. And what I would ask everyone to keep in mind is that our current system takes a lot of energy and time too, right? And we're not getting the results that are meeting people's needs. And the truth is, you know, PB is a process, right? There are clear steps. There are ways to bring people in with intention. We focus a lot on facilitation and building community leadership to hold these processes with integrity. And importantly, inviting folks in who have never had the opportunity to have a say on the budgets and policies that impact their lives. We know it's a practice. We know it's something that's going to build, and it'll take time and energy to do it right. But maintaining the current system takes time and energy too.
how does spending change when residents have a say in the budgeting process? What do you see?
Yeah, I think, you know, a powerful example comes from the birthplace of participatory budgeting, which was Porto Alegre, Brazil. And in 1989, PB started there. And what researchers found, they looked at the period from 1994 to 2004, and they saw that in municipalities that implemented PB, there was a reduction in infant mortality. So babies dying by 5 to 10%, a reduction in infant mortality. And the reason for that is actually really simple. By putting the power of decision making on how spending happened, so letting residents decide where money went, they chose the things that mattered most to their health and well-being. And that was sanitation, public health, and that had a direct impact on the health of people living in Porto Alegre. And you know, there are other examples from across the country that we can talk a little bit about where people are really redirecting spending in a way that meets community needs.
Are there some common ground rules, if you will, for eligible projects? Like, what is in bounds here when people go through this process and pick some winners?
Yeah, absolutely. So a big piece, so the first phase of participatory budgeting is designing the process, Kate, and like really getting at what are the rules? What do we want to see come out of this process? And what do folks need to keep in mind as they generate ideas? One piece I would point to is that the values that shape the process are really important. And we always advocate for PB that's rooted in equity, accessibility, and significance. So folks are coming together to make decisions about things, you know, budgets that are significant and meaningful to them, that barriers are being reduced to participation so everyone can participate, and that equity is really centered so that folks who have been historically marginalized have not, their communities have been disinvested from, have the opportunity to shift that dynamic. And then feasibility is also really important. This is a collaboration. PB is a collaboration with folks working in government, with community leaders, people with knowledge about their neighborhoods. They're coming together to design what is feasible. And so there's a role for expertise there. There's a role for local leaders and government leaders to help shape projects to make sure that they can happen.
I'm going to reintroduce here as we talk about PB, participatory budgeting, residents voting on how to spend public money. Ingrid Hafdahl with us. Ingrid is Director of Community Education at the Participatory Budgeting Project. You can join in with your questions and comments on this type of process, 800-642-1234. So Ingrid, what happens if a state or a city, a municipality doesn't follow through with the budgeting choices or doesn't make the process whole in some way or complete it?
That undermines the credibility of the process, absolutely. And I think one thing that we recognize, Kate, is that this is part of a growing movement for participatory democracy. And any one PB process is super important, and it's important to experiment, but these are practices and tools that we need to build together. And it's part of a growing movement for community-led decision-making that's equitable, accessible, and significant. And some might not end up the way that community members hope, but it's important to continue coming together and practicing these things, because we know we have to shift how decisions are made when it comes to the budgets and policies that impact our lives.
So when you really focus on the inclusiveness of it and engaging marginalized people who lack a seat at the table, if you will, you know, do you see more equitable distribution of these funds, of these resources?
Yeah. So I think there's research out of New York City where people are redirecting resources to lower income neighborhoods, lower wealth neighborhoods that have been disinvested in over many decades. And it's also a product of PB participatory budgeting is designed to be inclusive and inclusive of folks who might be ineligible to participate in typical elections. That means folks who have been incarcerated. That means folks of all immigration statuses, and certainly also communities of folks who are typically underrepresented in elections, including Black, Indigenous, and people of color, low-income people, and young people. So another key piece of this is that PB is designed to be inclusive of young participants too. You don't need to be 18. In fact, we've had very young participants participate in PB. So
I think I saw a picture of fifth graders in New
York. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I laugh. I have a three-year-old and I'm like, maybe I draw the line at two or three. Absolutely. And like, you know, it's, I think that's one of the most inspiring pieces. This is happening in school districts across the country. Young people are coming together to really claim their leadership and learn how to practice participatory democracy together through PB.
Let's bring on a call. Casey in Watertown. Casey, hi, what is your question?
Well, I actually participated in the participatory budgeting in Eau Claire, and I used to live there. I was homeless there, and part of the money went to solar panels on this homeless shelter there, which nobody there wants. And so my comment is, and I'm kind of biased, shame on Eau Claire. I'd like to know if they released any sort of press release as to why they're choosing to no longer participate. I have a feeling it's because the money didn't go where they wanted it to go.
Casey, thank you for that. And additional context, in 2021, the city of Eau Claire dedicated $300,000 to a participatory budgeting project. And the city told WPR it discontinued the pilot after one cycle, saying it needed a community partner to lead the project, and no one stepped up. And so it leads us to ask, Ingrid, how should smaller cities approach this?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we're, again, recognizing that this does take time and resources, but I think the other piece of this is that beyond any one participatory budgeting cycle, we need to do things to make sure that things like participatory budgeting and participatory democracy more broadly remain sustainable over the long term. So often these projects, you know, are initiated by an elected official who's excited to try it out, and that is great. But we know that things can change quickly when people change office, when there's, you know, turnover in public agencies. So I think our question is, what can we do to make these make PB sustainable over the long term? I think we can look to places like Boston, which Boston actually changed their city charter and created a public office of participatory budgeting to ensure that long-term sustainability. And I think there are other things that we can do to make sure that it's not just about any one particular pilot project, but that the infrastructure is there for the long term.
Ingrid Haftel with us with the participatory budgeting project, explaining this civic engagement approach. Bring your questions. What's on your mind about allocating pots of money through PB, participatory budgeting? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the spread of PB, participatory budgeting, in communities around the country, and what it could mean here in Wisconsin as Milwaukee, a nonprofit, plans to allow residents to vote on how to spend some funds. Join in with questions and concerns on how participatory budgeting works. 800-642-1234. Ingrid Haftel heads up community education at the Participatory Budgeting Project and stays with us. Let's go to Ron in Pioneer, Missouri. Ron, what's on your mind?
Local flood control projects. Every state, county, city needs to look carefully about that. And the local voters and listeners can push the politicians. Here, last month, the building my niece lived in had 24 inches of flood water inside the building. And you can imagine that it destroyed most of her property that she had in the building. Infiltration basins is a cheaper option, but rain gardens with lots of flowers are beautiful options to catch the floodwater that comes off your own roof, your own driveway, the sidewalks. You can even catch stormwater that flows down the streets.
Ron, envisioning, yes, envisioning so many projects related to flood control. Ingrid, would these types of projects be feasible in participatory budgeting?
We're thinking about flooding, climate resilience. There are absolutely examples of communities coming together to decide what they need to become more resilient to climate change. Chicago, I believe, had a special process that was focused on generating ideas for things like green roofs, rain gardens. And I think the beauty of it is PB would ask folks like Ron to propose the ideas that work for them in their neighborhoods, on their blocks. It's going to the people who are impacted by the problems and asking for them to shape the solution.
Turning to Milwaukee here for a moment, the African American Roundtable is implementing a PB project. And the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports the city of Milwaukee is against the project because people already have a voice in the budget. So why might city leaders discourage a participatory budgeting process?
Yeah, it's a question we encounter in our work often. And I think, you know, some people say, well, like, you know, I elected my mayor, my local city councilor. Shouldn't they make the decisions about budgeting? And I think our response to that is it's an impossible job to imagine that any one elected official can hold the deep experience and the needs, the real material needs of people living their lives in their communities. It's just not reasonable, and we see that it's not working. So participatory budgeting, again, really centers folks who are most impacted and gives them a say. I do think sometimes there's this, you know, fear that folks are giving up their expertise or giving up their role. And I think what we say is, no, this is just a new kind of leadership, right? It's a way to lead with community together in a way that's going to produce decisions that we know are more effective and certainly more equitable.
Your website is saying that 7,000 cities around the world have this type of budgeting process, and the process is unique to each place, of course. What factors do you consider when building a participatory budgeting project? What would you suggest as some initial steps?
Sure. I think the first step is always making sure that you are designing with impacted community members, right? So if the process is going to happen in a neighborhood or a city, that you're actually turning to folks there from the very beginning to get their feedback on how it should go down. And then I think, you know, we recommend building advisory committees of community members who can create transparency and accountability throughout the process. So again, it's not just community-led in terms of having a vote on what ends up getting funded, but it's community-led from the very beginning. And finally, you know, we really root in the values of equity, accessibility, and significance, that to change things for the better, to make sure that folks' basic needs are being met, and even better, that they're able to propose things that will help them thrive, that, you know, we have to root in the values of equity, accessibility, and making sure that these budgets are significant to communities.
How do you address obstacles like keeping people engaged through a multi-step process and the need for reliable flow of funds, of public funds, to keep it going? What's some advice there?
Yeah. Great question. And you will hear a theme, Kate, in my responses, which is like, get community, you know, one of the most powerful parts of PB is that outreach happens by and for community members. So what we often advise is that the process builds in funding and support for community ambassadors, for local organizations that are already connected to communities, to be the ones in charge of outreach. And we see incredibly, like, you know, creative responses. In Seattle, I know that we have there are some youth fellows, some young people who are leading outreach in Seattle and doing that in creative ways with art and culture and in ways that are keeping folks engaged and excited about the process.
Talking with Ingrid Haftel, Director of the Community Education at the Participatory Budgeting Project. You can join in at 800-642-1234. A bit more here on Seattle. You mentioned the City Council had earmarked about $30 million in the 2021 budget to run a participatory budget process. And the goal was to reduce police violence and reduce crime following the murder of George Floyd in 2020. How is that process going for the city of Seattle?
Yeah. So this is an incredibly, I think, inspiring example of participatory budgeting that's happening. And as you said, Kate, the process was in direct response to the murder of George Floyd. But it was also building on a long history of Black-led organizing against disinvestment in Seattle and against anti-Black racism. So folks came together and said, we don't have to do things the way that we've been doing them. We know it's not working. And one of the ways that that became a part of the PB process was actually took $12 million, I believe, out of the Seattle Police Department budget and put it into PB. And that has been, the process itself has been shaped deeply by community-led researchers and community engagement to, again, design the rules and goals for the process. It's just getting underway and things are kicking off. And we're very excited to see how folks come together and re-envision community safety in a community-defined way and shift funding to communities in the ways that they need it to be shifted.
Does your research and data connect any dots to voter turnout? Does participatory budgeting increase voter turnout?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an exciting dimension of participatory budgeting. It doesn't just, the effects don't stay within the PB process itself, but it actually, we saw in New York City that participatory budgeting voters were more likely to vote in elections after participating in PB. And that's especially true for groups who are less likely to vote, people under 30, residents from low-income neighborhoods. And that effect was even for folks who didn't participate in the PB process were still more likely to vote in ordinary elections after their district introduced PB.
Is there a general advice or on the right amount of funds to have for the process to be sustainable and to get up and running?
Yeah. You're bringing up an important piece, which you need the pot of funding that folks can come together and decide. And that, we like to remind people that it's not a new budget item, right? It's just changing our thinking about how we make decisions about our existing budget. And then there needs to be resources for implementation as well. As an organization, we're happy to provide. There's lots of free tools and resources on participatorybudgeting.org where folks can go to find more detailed information on the types of resources and support we recommend when it comes to places implementing participatory budgeting.
Ingrid, thank you for joining us.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Kate.
Ingrid Haftel is Community Education Director at the Participatory Budgeting Project. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.